This is a recording of the Michael Lerner teleconference with Common Wheel for April 28th, 2006 at 11 a.m. Central Time.
Dr. Michael Kundi, who is a professor at the University of Vienna, will be on, as well as some other colleagues, both from California and outside the state. Operator, are folks coming on? I'm not hearing them. Usually we hear lots of folks.
This is Karen Moore from Resolve.
Oh, great.
And this is Kyla Bow from the National Association of State Directors of Developmental Disability Services.
Wonderful. Welcome.
Viola Kaufman from Cal EPA.
Neil Gendel, Healthy Children Organizing Project.
Good morning, Neil.
Good morning.
Joe Colborne and Lynn Terrell from TEDx.
Hi. Pat Hilgard from EPA.
Welcome.
Spinoza from Reproductive Health Technologies Project.
Welcome.
Sophia Dorsano from the Endometriosis Association.
Carolyn Rathensberger with the Science and Environmental Health Network.
Yes.
Alexandra Gorman from Women's Voices for the Earth.
Ed Moore from Second Look.
Yes, Jimmy Spiro, University of California, Davis.
Good morning. Alice Shabakoff here.
Welcome, Phil.
Thanks.
Lynn Cannon, LDA.
Good morning,
Lynn. Liesl Syriac, Silent Spring Institute.
Liesl. And just to let folks know while we wait for another minute or so, we do have a live blog on our website for folks to type in comments or questions like our moderator is reading. So if you are interested in doing that, you can go to our website at www.healthandenvironment.org.
Thank you.
And I will go over those instructions in my little preamble. But if you look at the What's New box, the first item under it, if you click on that, it'll take you to the page that you need to be.
Thank you.
How can we mute our phones?
Well, we will actually...
The
operator is going to put everyone in a mute mode as soon as we get critical mass.
Okay.
Only the presenters will be in talk mode. I think we should probably start, Steve.
I heard Dr. Ronsal on there, did I?
Yes, we have Dr. Griffith, Dr. Michaels, and Dr. Kennedy all on.
Yeah, the operator I'm showing, the only speakers that we're missing are Mr. Kennedy and Mr. Gusner.
I think Dr. Kennedy has joined us, has he not?
Yes.
Yes, he's on.
And Dr. Gusner and Dr. Ronsal will be later on in the program.
I'm here. So what
I'm on.
Wonderful.
This is Chris Ronsal.
Okay, so operator, if you could so kindly put everyone except for the speakers in the muted mode, that would be wonderful.
Okay, it'll be just a moment while I get all the lines on mute. One moment.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Ms. Greifel on talk with it, Ms. Sotos, Mr. Kennedy, Mr. Heilig, Mr. Michaels.
Okay, wonderful.
Ms. Vershovsky and Mr. Von Saul. Everyone else is now on mute.
Okay. All right, can everyone hear me?
Yep.
Okay, wonderful. Good morning, everyone. My name is Eleni Sotos. I'd like to welcome you to today's teleconference. It's titled Preserving the Integrity of Science, Research, and Policy Considerations. The moderator for this call will be Steve Heilig, Director of Public Health and Education for the San Francisco Medical Society and the Collaborative on Health and the Environment. Please note that we have some useful resources available on the CHE website, pertaining to this call, including a new live web blog function and numerous articles and reports relevant to today's topic. The live blog is available for call participants to post comments and questions during today's call, and you don't need special software other than a connection to the internet to actually enter on the blog. To access the blog and these other resources, go to our website at www.healthandenvironment.org. And on the left-hand side of your screen, you'll see a What's New box. And the first item under that What's New box pertains to today's call, and just click on that link. And that will take you to the page that contains both the resources and the blog link as well. Please note that we are also now offering live streaming audio of the partnership calls for those of you who may want to listen to the calls via your computer using this method in the future. So if you are overseas or if you don't have access to a telephone, you can listen live to our national partnership calls on your computer starting today. Before we begin, I'd like to cover some important logistical information regarding the call. Please note that everyone, with the exception of our guest speakers, has been placed in listen-only mode. At the conclusion of the presentations, the operator will unmute all of the lines so that you may participate in the question and answer period if you choose to do so. To be mindful of the process during the Q&A period, identify yourself before you speak, and please keep your comment or question brief. And I also wanted to mention that if you do type in the blog a question or comment, that Steve and I are monitoring it, and Steve can actually pull questions and comments off of that as the Q&A period commences. Please note that this call will last 1 hour. It's being recorded, and an audio MP3 file will be available on the CHE website for downloading over the coming weeks. I would also like to note that next month's National Partnership Call will focus on the topic of electromagnetic radiation. The call is scheduled for May 24th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. More information about this call will be disseminated over the coming weeks. I'd like to now turn the call over to Steve. Steve?
Thank you very much, Eleni, and good day, everyone. Thanks for joining in here. We're very pleased to have this call today, even though it's about a troubling topic. And I studied biology as an undergraduate and learned, as in anybody who studies science, that you go to great pains to try to remove and avoid bias in your research and in the applications of research, whether that's investigator, statistical, or otherwise. And interestingly enough, I read a book by Chase Chairman Phil Lee in the 1970s where I was working on a paper on antibiotic use or overuse, and he noted in there that a number of scientists had resigned from a federal panel in protest over meddling by pharmaceutical industry and politicians. And that was my first instance of seeing that there were other kinds of bias being introduced at times. Now, of course, in more recent years, we've had a lot of reports and a lot of concern voiced. And in California, Congressman Henry Waxman, a leading Democrat, commissioned a report some years back that was posted on this, and we have also had reports from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Center for Science and the Public Interest, and you'll hear about some of these today from people who have been intimately involved with those. The issues are across the board concerning the issue of climate change, and environmental chemicals, other kinds of drugs, tobacco, emergency contraception, and just a wide range of topics. And in even more recent time, of course, when you know an issue has hit the big time and shows up on the cover of Time magazine, The New Yorker, I would encourage people to take a look at the current issue of Vanity Fair about the global warming issue, where it has shown that some of the scientists funded by Exxon to debunk cast doubt on the issue of climate change are some of the same people who were hired by the tobacco industry and doing the same kinds of work then. And, of course, if you really hit the mainstream, you get into Doonesbury and a recent Doonesbury cartoon that we wanted to post on our site, but I wasn't sure about copyright on this. But it has the White House situational science advisor saying you must always teach the controversy about things like evolution, global warming, mercury, pesticides, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a new tack on it that you always need to talk about the controversy. So when I interviewed Congressman Waxman some years ago about this issue, and I had to voice the question to him, could this not be seen as just a political report since you are a leading Democrat and it's in a way attacking the White House, his response was, well, if the editor of Science, Donald Kennedy, is concerned about this, that's good enough for me, and I don't know what Donald Kennedy's political affiliation or party is, if any. So we will turn to our first speaker. We're very honored to have Dr. Kennedy on, who is Editor-in-Chief of Science, has been President of Stanford University, Commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. He's a biologist and is being Professor Emeritus of Environmental Science at Stanford now, has bachelor's and doctorate degrees from Harvard University, and is a member of the National Academy of Sciences. So please, Dr. Kennedy.
Well, if Henry Waxman doesn't know what political party I belong to, he has a short memory because he was on one of my oversight committees when I was commissioner of the FDA. Henry has done, I think, a very interesting job at one of the aspects of the integrity of science. And I took my duty to be to introduce several versions of the integrity problem, because all three of the areas I want to touch on briefly have received a lot of attention lately. First is the matter of research fraud. It's rare. It's very difficult to detect, even by rigorous peer review. And because we've been involved in publishing one or two things in the past 6 years that have proven to be fraudulent, it's given me an opportunity to make the point to anybody who's willing to listen that replication is the ultimate test of truth in science. It's not publication in a peer-reviewed journal. It's whether somebody else can find the same fact using the same methods. Why does fraud happen? It happens because scientists work in a prestige economy, and the rewards are considerable for discovery, and some people, I think, are tempted to cheat, and it's too bad. But we all need to remember that truth in science comes about by replication and confirmation. We've also seen a lot of fuss about conflicts of interest, particularly in clinical trials and other kinds of research that are likely to have significant medical or agricultural applications. And it's been important to develop policies at our journal and elsewhere by which we can identify conflicts of interest on the part of authors if they appear. We regularly ask about them and disclose them when we consider them relevant. It hasn't been much of an issue for our journal because we don't publish an awful lot of clinical research, and we're certainly not into the clinical trials literature. But I think everyone knows that there have been some cases in which clinical trials have been incompletely reported, or negative ones unreported, and the government and other institutions are trying to do something about that, sponsored in part by some concern on the part of medical journal editors, to make sure that the protocols for clinical trials are listed and posted before the trial begins and published at the end so that everybody knows what the result would be. But conflicts of interest arise because, in addition to working in a prestige economy, scientists, particularly life scientists, now find themselves working also in a dollar economy, some of whom for the first time. Finally, I think the main purpose of this discussion was to have been looking at the question of whether scientific data or results are either manipulated or selectively used in an effort to make the science suit some desired policy objective. I think that's been a serious problem in this administration. People often say to me, well, it was serious surely in the past as well. This is nothing new. That's politics. My own view is that, yes, it's happened before, but I think that the degree to which it has happened in this past two presidential terms is unusually intensive. I've worried, for example, about wholesale replacement or substitution of individuals with a certain view on committees that are designed to evaluate research and to bring their own expertise apart from political judgments to judging the quality of the research, and those substitutions have often been troublesome. The editing or change in proposed regulations from the Environmental Protection Agency, in reports from Fish and Wildlife Service scientists on data that are relevant to the Endangered Species Act, have also gotten quite a lot of attention. I wrote at the end of one editorial in a probably not very effective effort to paraphrase Secretary Rumsfeld. It's as though we don't go to policy with the science we have; we go with the science we want. And I think it's an unfortunate tendency. I think I'll leave it there for additional comments from my colleagues. But those are the three domains in which I think scientific integrity has come to the fore in the past several years.
Thank you, Dr. Kennedy, and we'll have some discussion after these presentations as well. So we'll turn now to Dr. David Michaels, who is Research Professor and Associate Chairman of the Department of Environmental and Occupational Health at George Washington University's School of Public Health. He directs the doctoral program there and also directs the Project on Scientific Knowledge and Public Policy. He has written many articles, including being the guest editor of a special issue on this topic of the American Journal of Public Health. And he has also served as the Department of Energy's Assistant Secretary for the Environment. And just this year, a couple months ago, received the American Association for the Advancement of Sciences Scientific Freedom and Responsibility Award. Dr. Michaels.
Thank you very much. I'm going to talk today a little bit about what I call manufactured uncertainty and the product defense industry. As background, I think we have to recognize that our understanding of the effects of toxic chemicals on humans is always incomplete. There's always some uncertainty, and there's often a great deal of it. For the most part, we can't intentionally conduct experiments that expose people to toxic chemicals, so we rely on the results of toxicology, animal experiments, and epidemiology, which some have called the examination of the natural, unplanned experiments of people's lives. But we never have perfect data, and we make decisions to protect the public health and the environment, knowing that we may not always be right, but that real uncertainty exists. When I talk about manufactured uncertainty, I'm talking about a strategy by polluters and the manufacturers of hazardous products to delay or prevent regulation by inventing or magnifying scientific uncertainty. Years ago, a tobacco executive wrote a famous memo that perfectly captured the cigarette maker's disinformation campaign. He explained, and this is a quote, "Doubt is our product since it's the best means of competing with the body of fact that exists in the minds of the general public." For 50 years, tobacco companies employed a stable of scientists to assert that they didn't believe there was conclusive evidence that cigarettes caused lung cancer. The tobacco industry scientists manufactured uncertainty by dissecting every study, highlighting flaws and inconsistencies, and their own scientists conducted studies that were made public only if they approved the findings. As a result, public health protection, along with compensation for tobacco's victims, were delayed for years. This approach is now standard operating procedure for polluters. The most well-known example is the campaign to stir doubt about global warming. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with the Frank Luntz memo. He's a leading Republican political consultant. And he actually told the Republican Party that voters believed there is no consensus about global warming in the scientific community. If the public realized there was a consensus among scientists, their views would change and presumably demand that government take some action. So while we know a lot about this campaign and we know about tobacco, less well known are the current campaigns mounted to question the science documenting the adverse health effects of exposure to atrazine, benzene, beryllium, chromium, formaldehyde, lead, mercury, perchlorates, phthalates, silica. I could go on and on. In fact, I do. Some of the documents Michael referred to, and they're linked on the website, talk about those. You could look at our website, www.defendingscience.org, that has a lot of those papers. But manufacturing uncertainty on behalf of big business actually has become a big business in itself. There are firms that specialize in product defense, and that's their term, not mine. They're staffed with very sharp and very well-paid consultants in epidemiology, toxicology, biostatistics. To me, the work of these product defense firms bears the same relationship to science as the Arthur Andersen Company's work on accounting, does to accounting, essentially, before it went bankrupt following the Enron debacle. Essentially, it provides what looks like authoritative permission to do things that really do not contribute to the social good. Product defense scientists know that their work is more valuable to their corporate sponsors if they're published in a peer-reviewed journal, because many outside the scientific community equate peer review with accurate or valid. Journals that publish these so-called studies are, to me, little more than vanity publications, but the studies look impressive. you know, when we see these studies, which and any scientist can look through them and see that they're really sort of faux studies, they're easily, at one time, they were easily disregarded by scientists working in regulatory agencies. But they're very useful tools for the political appointees who are looking for justification to issue little or no regulation. And they're also very important in court cases, since judges and juries are not experienced separating, you know, wheat from the scientific chaff. So what do we do? The first, and I think Francesca is going to address this to some extent, but I think we need to rethink the regulatory paradigm. I think federal agencies need to ensure that the data and analyses that are provided by manufacturers who have a vested interest in the outcome are independently verified. And the opinions submitted to regulatory agencies by corporate scientists, and especially by these essentially paid consultants, should be looked at as advocacy primarily, not as science. And the other thing is to just remember that we have to return to the first, essentially basic principles. We have to use the best science available, but we can't demand uncertainty where it does not exist.
Thank you very much, Dr. Michaels. And I would recommend anybody who's interested in more depth to look at his article from the June 2005 Scientific American, which is just called Doubt is Their Product, and that's available on our website. So we will turn now to Dr. Francesca Grifo, who is a botanist, and trained as a botanist and a senior scientist and director of the Scientific Integrity Program of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and came there from Columbia University, where she was director of the Center for Environmental Research and Conservation Graduate Policy Workshop, and has been director of the Center of Biodiversity and Conservation and curator of the Hall of Biodiversity at the American Museum of Natural History. And she has edited and contributed to the books Biodiversity and Human Health, and The Living Planet in Crisis, Biodiversity, Science, and Policy. So please go ahead.
Thank you very much. I want to thank the Collaborative for inviting me to be part of this call. And I really want to thank the many of you that I know are out there on mute who have already worked very hard on this issue. The one thing that makes me crazy about these kinds of conversations is we leave them all full of, you know, depression and angst. And what I wanted to do today was talk a little bit about solutions, because I think it's a good way to end a discussion with an idea of what you can and should and perhaps ought to do about it. You know, the solutions are out there. David alluded to some. But I think what they really require is the, you know, the persistent and energetic engagement of the scientific and health communities. And that's why this is such an opportunity for us. I think this is really appropriate for this community because, in fact, we are the ones who see the consequences of the abuses. You know, we are the knowledge stewards, and I think if we go back, it's our intellectual curiosity that got us into the careers we now have, and we need to make sure that those opportunities to exercise that intellectual curiosity remain possible for us and for young people that are considering these careers and considering activism on these issues. And there are big threats to that, as you've heard about on the earlier part of this call. I think we can create change in a democracy in two ways. I mean, obviously through engagement and through policy reform. And pretty clearly, the engagement is meant to lead to the policy reform. But I think the engagement piece is where we can really play a key role. I think it's easy for us to forget the enormous credibility that both science and the health community have with a multitude of audiences, and that's real power. It's real power for us to tell, you know, Congress, our constituencies, our science, our students, our neighbors, you know, whoever will listen, that these abuses have real impacts on health. And there are many examples, and there are links on the CHE website to our page where those examples are documented. But we're talking about, you know, childhood lead poisoning, drug safety, particulate matter pollution, mercury emissions, toxic release inventory suppression, I mean, and on and on. There's a very, very long list, as Dr. Kennedy also alluded to. But I think, you know, the policy reform is complex. It's more complex than here's a law that will prevent the abuse of science. But we do have legislation currently before both the House and Senate with multiple co-sponsors, but unfortunately it's all dressed up with no place to go. We are quite limited right now by political realities, and unfortunately, again, as Dr. Kennedy alluded to, the perception is out there that this is a partisan issue. And I think we are all really able to tell the world that, like environmental issues and health issues and climate change, the politicization of science is not a partisan issue. That while we have impartial and partial science and research undertaken by those with major conflicts of interest and research undertaken by those with minimal or no conflicts of interest, there really is no such thing as Republican or Democratic science. So where does that leave us? Well, we are currently, you know, continuing to press for amendments on current appropriations bills to try and get some language in there. And we will work really hard in the next Congress to see a bill that it's, you know, I was talking to somebody about this and they said, I can't believe that that's where you're starting. But we're starting with a bill that will say, you know, government employees may not tamper with or censor federally funded scientific research. They cannot direct the false, I mean, the dissemination of false information. And it is, we have to begin that in that basic a place. But we're also looking at ways to protect government scientists by strengthening whistleblower protections, and this is important. Strengthening the independence of the federal advisory boards, again, as Dr. Kennedy alluded to. But I think our efforts, and I think all of our efforts over the next couple of years, will really be to see the election of a president who will take effective action to restore and protect science. And again, you know, this is not partisan. This is whichever party it comes from. The clearly important thing is that we get somebody who understands this issue and who will take effective action to change the, what has become, unfortunately, business as usual. So we are looking very hard to identify and recruit and train and deploy, you know, knowledgeable groups of scientists and health professionals and industry leaders to really start conversations with candidates, all candidates, now to make these commitments. And we really invite you to join us in that effort. But we're also looking at agency reform. Over the last couple of years, we have surveyed over 8,000 scientists in five agencies to document the abuses of science in those agencies. And again, those results are available through the link on the CHEA website. And we come away from that with such questions as, you know, how is it that lower-level political appointees are wielding so much power? How could agency structures be changed to prevent this or make it harder to do or at least make it really obvious when it happens? And what about, you know, the agency media policies? There's been a lot of attention towards that lately, and we're working with colleagues to try and develop a model policy that could be adopted that would really protect the rights of all federal employees to speak the truth and obviously still hold on to their jobs. I mean, we're looking at getting to the pre-whistleblower issues and to prevent the need for whistleblowers by trying to, you know, shine a light on these things within the agencies. So I think obviously we could use help with all of this, and I think you're probably familiar with our scientist statement from 2 years ago. We have over 9,000 signers, 49 Nobel Prize winners, 173 National Academy members, but we really need you because this is the first step for us to engage you in our work and to work with us on these issues. We send out one or two alerts a month. We are sent one out this week on the Wareham nomination, and it was quite exciting. It generated 3,000 calls, and a senator went from no position on the nomination to actually opposing the nomination to putting a hold on it from the beginning of the day when the calls began to the end of the day when the calls ended. So we really can focus our attention on things and create change. So if you are a scientist or a health professional or working towards a degree, please go to the website. It's on the CHEA website and join us. If not, we have a citizen's call to action and you can still join us. You know, I think we also need to bear in mind that we have to be the voices for our federal colleagues who really can't speak out on so many of these issues. So I want to just conclude by saying thank you and please join us, call us, tell us your stories, and we're going to keep working on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'll just say personally, this work makes me proud to be a longtime UCS member. We have a couple of other people on the call who have very intimate knowledge of these issues, too, sometimes reluctantly, I think, but we will start with Meryl Guzner, who is director of the Integrity of Science Program at the Center for Science in the Public Interest, and they have a database which is linked from our CHEA website as well. Meryl?
I think the operator might need to unmute Meryl.
Oh, I thought she was on. Well, Fred, are you on?
Yes, I am.
Oh, okay, we'll start then with Fred Bronsaw, who is in the Division of Biological Sciences at the university and has done some leading work, endocrine disruption and so on, and has some remarks I believe he wants to make.
Yes, thank you very much. And what I'll do is follow up on some comments made by Dr. Michaels concerning corporate-funded studies. And I'm going to discuss this in relation to two chemicals, bisphenol A and phthalates, that are each worth tens of billions of dollars a year. For bisphenol A, there are over 6 billion pounds produced a year to produce polycarbonate resins and plastics, and these are being dumped into landfills from which this unstable polymer is breaking down. There's now extensive evidence in the published literature for widespread human exposure throughout the entire world to very similar levels of this chemical, below levels causing harm in animal studies. And this is now based on hundreds of studies published by government-funded scientists over the past 8 years. For instance, there were over 130 animal studies funded by government showing harm at human exposure levels to bisphenol A, and over 70 studies of molecular mechanisms. Of importance, 100% of the 12 industry-funded studies on this subject report absolutely no harm of this chemical. The American Chemistry Council, Doubt is Our Product campaign, as Dr. Michaels would call it, is being coordinated by the Weinberg Group. They're the same group that coordinated this activity for the asbestos, tobacco, perfluorinated compounds, as recently discussed in a Environmental Science and Technology article on February 22nd, entitled The Weinberg Proposal, that has a phenomenal letter from the Weinberg Group to DuPont that everybody should read. And Dr. Michaels is quoted in there as saying their strategy is, we'll make sure the science comes out the way you want it. It's very obvious that's what they're doing. So what is the consequence of this? In written and verbal testimony to the California legislature a few months ago, and they were trying to restrict the use of phthalates and bisphenol A in baby products, the American Chemistry Council presented in writing a statement saying reported low-dose effects have not been replicated in repeat studies conducted in independent laboratories. The vast majority of data show no low-dose effects whatsoever. They also stated typical human exposure is a million times lower than levels shown to cause no adverse effects in multi-generation animal studies, which indicate a large margin of safety. That statement is based on one study funded by the chemical industry with an estrogen-insensitive model rat, and that study was designed to fail. So that is blatant fraud being presented to a legislature that is really reminiscent of what the tobacco industry executives did about a decade ago. And the consequence of this for the government is that Dr. George Pauly, Associate Director for Science and Policy at the FDA, reported in writing to the California legislature as the position of the FDA that it was, FDA is aware of several reports stating that bisphenol A has estrogenic activity. However, other reports appear to dispute any reason to expect harm at low doses that humans are exposed to. They also went on to say the FDA sees thus no reason to ban bisphenol A, and that FDA approved bisphenol A for use in food in 1963 under generally regarded as safe standards graph. Since it has been used for a number of years and there was no evidence of harm, as I'm sure everyone knows, GRAS is based on no evidence of harm due to no research being done. I have sent to CHE a PDF of an environmental research article I just published that goes through in great detail how exactly the chemical industry created these studies that report no harm. And I'm particularly interested and very happy to have Dr. Kennedy on this call, because it's unfortunate that science, more than any other major journal, has apparently been influenced by this attempted this campaign by the chemical industry to create this illusion of doubt. And in a recent editorial by Jocelyn Kaiser in Science about a panel meeting at the National Toxicology Program, it was titled, Panel Finds No Proof That Phthalates Harm Infant Reproductive System. This is really not what the panel discussed. They discussed just one chemical, and yet she went on to state the phthalate review puts the burden of proof back on those who attribute harm to these so-called endocrine-disrupting human-made chemicals. In other words, she took a very limited review of one chemical and essentially used it to discredit a whole field. And this contrasts dramatically with a couple of Wall Street Journal articles by Peter Waldeman in July and October on the same subject that were really well thought out. And so I think what we need is a much greater understanding of the degree to which corporations are willing to bias research that directly impacts billions of dollars worth of products, and that the impact is felt within the scientific community and the public at large. And we need a really good understanding of this within the editorial policies of our scientific journals to get beyond this issue.
Can I make a correction?
Well, yes, I was going to...
That was not an editorial. It was a news report by a science journalist who is employed by science reporting what happened at a panel. One may not like what happened at the panel, but the report, I think, was accurate, and if anyone doubts it, we'd love to have a letter.
Thank you.
Just one thing. She was not at the meeting, and that's the issue, is that there was a tremendous discrepancy between what was discussed at the meeting and what was reported. But I don't want to get into that. It's just that...
Well, you've already got into it.
We're into it. But let's... Is Meryl Guzner on now?
Yes, I am.
And we can come up. Okay. Do you want to make a few remarks on the CSPI report and database that you have? And please be brief here if you can.
Yes, I will be very brief because I realize the time is you want to open it up for questions. Let me just... I hear a unifying theme that I think has not been stressed enough, and so let me just address my remarks to that. With the sole exception, really, of the reproductive health issue, where I think that there is an ideological agenda that has nothing to do with economic interests. Firstly, all of these issues are linked together by an underlying economic interest. So Dr. Kennedy mentioned about, it's mostly in clinical trials. Actually, that is to sell a product, and if you look at the environmental side of this issue, it's sort of to defend products, to make sure that they're not regulated or to stop, companies are using science as a way of trying to reduce regulation or to avoid regulation. And I think that we have to understand that both of these trends are really, long-standing historical trends now really over 30 years. I mean, you can trace the increasing involvement of the medical profession in science to the Bayh-Dole Act from 1980, and you can trace, a 25, 30-year campaign by the corporate community to sort of roll back the environmental regulations that came into place in the, early 1970s. And so this is not really just about politics. And I think that any approach to resolving these questions that only focuses on politics will only get at part of the problem. And so that's why I think that as we talk about solutions to this, I think that if we look at government-funded budgets for science that is truly independent over the last 20 years, we'll see, at least in real terms, a real significant decline. And as a result, the field of science is sort of getting swamped by industry-funded science, which, of course, very often comes with an agenda. And secondly, I think that if you take a good hard look at the regulatory process at the federal government that has literally hundreds of advisory committees that bring in scientists, we see a consistent trend towards involvement by people who have ties to industry. Now, there was just a report out this week that said, well, if you actually look for a one-to-one correlation between who funds the scientists and how they vote, it doesn't have much impact, and this is at the FDA. But in fact, I think that there is such a thing as a mindset that takes place in the regulatory process when scientists are involved very intimately with industry in their research side or as speakers or in advisory boards or whatever it might be, that can create a kind of bias and, again, crowd out really independent, tough-minded people to ask hard, critical questions. when these things are up for consideration. And so I think that just in conclusion, I would just say I think that we really need to look at some of the underlying structures in the government, you know, in the advisory committees, and especially in how we fund science that's going to be used in the regulatory process as a way of getting at some of these underlying issues.
Thank you very much. We are going to go to the question and answers. We are encouraging people to use the blog if you can, if you are at a computer. If you're not, then we will do it via the telephone here. So I'm going to ask the operator now if you could unmute everyone.
All lines are now being unmuted.
And Dr. Kennedy, I was going to, even before the last comment there, since you went first, the speakers that came after you, if you had any comments as well briefly on them before we go to open questions.
No, I found myself very interested.
Great. Okay. So we then will ask people, Eleni, do we need to get people to do *6 to mute?
I don't think we'll try that today. We'll see if people can really keep their background noise down to a minimum because it's a little disruptive. So, operator, is everyone now unmuted?
Yes, ma'am. Everyone is unmuted.
Wonderful.
Okay. Well, we will entertain questions, and please do make it a question, not a statement. We'll be very brief on these because we want to hear from our speakers.
Hello. This is Dr. Gary from the University of Minnesota. I've got a question about the world of peer review. I sit on a series of peer review committees, and I've noticed that since the administration has come in, that there is detectable skewing of reports from the committees and that sort of thing. I've heard from some of the SRAs that they've actually asked whether or not the individual voted for whom to be on a member of this committee. And I'm kind of taken back by this whole thing. I just can't believe it's that politics has come to the level of the peer review committees.
Do our speakers have any comment on the issue of the selection process, I guess, or loading of peer review committees?
Well, I can say that at Science, we've received over the years a number of testimonials, if you want to call them that, from people who were asked quite directly, or even had their own party registration referred to in discussions in which they were being considered for advisory positions in evaluating research.
This is David Michael. I can add. I think there have been a number of pieces in Science magazine and also in the U.S. The UCS. Report on these sorts of activities. Many people in the scientific community have raised this concern, and I think it's very important that we continue to do so because, in fact, I think when it's picked up in the press and when there's discussion and when members of Congress complain, it makes it less likely to keep occurring. And I think we just have to be very vigilant.
Well, can I just add, we were successful with the recent HHS appropriations bill at getting language on there that specifically prohibits this. So if you have recent documented examples, we would love to know about them. So please email me.
Oh, I do.
Okay.
Yeah, no, we really, I'm quite serious.
Excellent. Okay. Another question, please, for the speakers.
I wonder if I could follow up on that one.
Oh, sure.
Would you make an argument that says that be appropriate for scientists when we are asked to serve on a panel to make our participation conditional on the absence of this kind of screening, so that we when asked to serve on a panel, we can say we'll serve if and only if you can assure us that none of this kind of political manipulation has occurred in the construction of the panel.
Manipulation of peer review committees
won't
be appointed unless your policy.
Is somebody speaking there right here?
I think it's Theo.
So it'd be sort of a boycott.
It sounds like it would require a widespread kind of solidarity in that respect, I guess.
Interesting idea.
Yeah.
Statement. Okay, do we have another question?
This is Phil Shabakov.
we recently interviewed Dr. Ken Holden, who thought it was a good thing to have very heavily involved in government research because, A, they have the resources, and B, the expertise in mechanicals. And he said that he considered industries to be ethical.
And do you have a question about that? You think that's appropriate, or you want?
Do the panelists agree with Ken Olden?
This is David Michaels. I don't think you can issue a sort of a blanket statement one way or the other. I think it all depends on the ground rules. I think it's very important that industry be involved in research on toxicology. It's also very important that they be involved in clinical trials. But are the proper controls and transparency requirements put on them is really what I would look at.
And this is Fred Van Saal. At least in the bisphenol A literature, we have an absolute clear dichotomy of 100% of industry-funded studies showing no harm, looking at exactly the same outcomes of about 130 government studies showing harm. And when you have those kind of data, they are really enlightening. And in fact, people in chemical corporations make it very clear, anybody associated with these multi-billion dollar products who comes out and says they're harmful will immediately be fired.
We have one from the online here, a question from Stephen Gilbert in Seattle, which is a basic question is, how do you distinguish conflict of interest from bias?
Well, this is Merrill Guzner speaking. I've actually spent a lot of time looking at this question. I mean, conflicts of interest are actually very easy to figure out. It really is all about the money. And it says, do you have some kind of financial tie between the person, a company that has funded your research or with whom you have some other type of relationship like a consultant, and the subject matter that you're investigating? Bias is a question about, do you bring to the subject a point of view? And that can be determined in a variety of ways, not just, and it's not about funding per se. So I know that in all of the work that we do on conflicts of interest, and we are very actively engaged in challenging scientists with conflicts of interest from serving on advisory committees, where they might, where they have been funded by somebody who has a stake in the outcome of what's being deliberated. But at the same time, you could have somebody sitting on that committee, for instance, who writes a lot of papers for the Hoover Institution or somebody else expressing opinions about that, and that can be a kind of bias. Now, we've gone one step further, and I've thought a lot about this, and in fact, it's backed up by a General Accountability Office report that came out in 2004 that looked at fellow advisory committees that said, you know, when there is a consistent pattern of a researcher doing research for industry, then you can say that this person more or less reflects a point of view that reflects industry, which gets to the issue that Dr. Van Saal just mentioned, which is that when you look, when you just do accounting of where studies come out on issues, who funds them has a direct correlation with what the outcomes are. It's been true in environmental research, and it's really true in medical research. And I've done some of those studies myself, where if you say, if industry funded the study, it says the drug is great, and if somebody independent takes a look at it, it says, well, maybe it's not so good, it doesn't have all that many effects, there's a lot of questions. There's a lot of speculation about why these things come out that way, but the correlation is definitely there. So you can separate out the two issues, yes, but sometimes having a consistent pattern of conflicts of interest can be the equivalent of having a bias, even though the two things are not the same.
And this was particularly latent in the environmental tobacco smoke research world, and there was a meta-analysis published in JAMA some years ago that showed that really the only variable identified in studies that showed no harm from secondhand smoke were those funded by the tobacco industry. Another. Do we have another question on the phone here? I will take one offline here. This is from David Balch, Commonweal, a colleague here, who says, thank you to Dr. Monsal for describing the chemical industry's blatant manipulation of science before the California legislature for political purposes. Would you explain a little more about the one flawed study on estrogen-insensitive rodents?
Actually, this was a study commissioned by the American Chemistry Council at an organization called Research Triangle Institute, and they took a rat bred by Charles River Laboratories for over 1,200 generations that requires now somewhere between 50 and 200 micrograms per kilogram of ethinyl estradiol to show any response. This is between 100 and 400 times higher than the dose of ethinyl estradiol in birth control pills. So this particular animal, according to positive control studies, is phenomenally sensitive to any estrogen and doesn't respond to bisphenol A except at essentially doses that kill it. And we have animals that respond to bisphenol A, and these other 100 and some articles show the same kind of thing in a wide variety of other animal models at literally 100,000 times lower dose. So you can go out and select the genetic model that is completely incapable of responding to the chemical of interest. Dr. Jimmy Spiro has written a white paper about this that is on the EPA website, although it took a tremendous amount of pressure to get them to do that. And so clearly you can design a study to fail and then exploit that study to create doubt, and that's what they did. This is described in great detail in the article that I sent to be posted on the website.
Okay. I would like to thank you for that. I would like to ask Dr. Kennedy, you were brief in your remarks, and we've limited the time, and you've heard afterwards, do you have suggestions for remedying some of the three concerns that you mentioned? You've written some about it, but do you have anything you want to say about that in terms of actual corrective action?
Well, I think in the long run, what has to be done is to establish some clear understandings about what kinds of positions in government particularly and in advisory committees to government should be absolutely unconnected to political party registration and to previous stated opinions regarding politics surrounding scientific issues. I thought that the committee on COSIPUP, the Committee on Science Policy of the Academies, was going to tackle that problem this year in its sort of every 3 years review of government science positions. And I think it's said the right things, but unfortunately none of that has yet been incorporated into law. Francesca made several very good points, I thought, about how one would begin to encode reasonable expectations about this in statute. But it's awfully, awfully hard as the so-called anti-lobbying provisions just enacted show to get any significant movement out of this Congress on that kind of issue. So I think it will be heavy lifting.
And that's on the various panels. How about on just the broader issue of manufacturing doubt and paralysis of movement on based on good science?
Well, I think the manufacturing doubt business, which I followed especially closely with respect to global warming, just what the scientific community needs to do is to keep repeating what the consensus is and making effective representations about the nature of that consensus. I think it's actually now starting to work with respect to climate change. I think people are becoming aware. I think Steve, you mentioned the Vanity Fair piece. That's just an example of the number of really carefully read periodicals that are beginning to shape a kind of public sense that consensus is arriving.
Right. We have a question here from Lisa Ledwidge regarding radiation health, and she writes that the poor, the government has defended itself from conflicts of interest complaints in Congress, et cetera, by saying the pool of experts in radiation health is small, such as health physicists, and most are or have been employed by government or industry. Is there a similar problem in other fields, and how might that be dealt with? We have a lack of expertise or unbiased expertise.
Well, let me make a quick comment on that. See, I think the problem is not to rule out of advisory committees anybody who has a bias due to past industry connections, but to balance them in the way the national academies normally try to do. I would have been very disappointed as FDA commissioner to find that no one who had ever been connected to industry could be on an advisory committee, because there's a lot of expertise there. The thing is that you want a variety of interests represented on those advisory committees, and they're actually pretty good at reaching consensus. So I'm less worried about bias than I am about balance.
This is Merrill Guzner. If I could jump in and respond. In fact, at the FDA just this week, there was a meeting of the Cardiovascular and Renal Drugs Advisory Committee where five of the seven people on the panel had conflicts of interest. They were discussing hypertensive labeling for antihypertensive drugs, which is a $7 billion a year industry, and it is often claimed virtually all the scientists who are expert in this field have some ties to industry. But in fact, the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute of NIH has spent over $100 million in the last 10 years studying this issue. There are scientists who have been working on those grants. They have a very clear point of view. They've written clinical practice guidelines, and the FDA, at least under this administration, for whatever reason, did not point a single one of those non-conflicted scientists to this panel who were experts in that area. My concern about these, not just FDA, but advisory committees across the government, is that when you make this, well, we don't want to exclude people with conflicts of interest because they often have a lot of expertise, which is true. What you end up doing is you end up crowding out independent scientists because, for whatever reason, a lot of the agencies of the federal government are now what the economists would call captured by the industries that they're supposed to be regulating and or leaning towards that direction. And as a result, we're seeing that really, truly tough-minded independent scientists are not just not being included, but for whatever reason are being excluded from a lot of these panels. And I think
Merrill, but citing one extreme case of imbalance isn't an argument against having a balanced committee.
No, that's what I'm saying is that we need to get balance on these committees, and raising the issue about conflicts of interest is one way of trying to call attention to the fact that, and it's not just one isolated case. This happens not just at the FDA, but at a lot of panels that we look at the EPA, and also, I might add, at the National Academies of Science, where you often will see panels that are dominated by scientists who have close ties to industries that are the subject matter of the study that is being conducted.
Can I jump in? My name is Steve Gibb, and I had a question about the HHS appropriations bill and language there. Does somebody have more specifics on that and what it actually spells out?
It spells out pretty much what was in our bigger legislation, but just for that particular group. I mean, it talks about scientific advisory panels. It talks about disseminating false and misleading information, and the full text of it is on the UCS website.
UCF?
Yeah, www.ucsusa.org, and the full text is there.
And that is, you can find those resources on the resources for this call.
Yes.
Do we have another question for the speakers?
I have a question. This is Julia Brody. I was wondering if the Union of Concerned Scientists and CSPI folks would talk about how you position yourselves with respect to these issues of conflict of interest and bias.
Merrill, you want to go ahead?
Well, sure. The fact is that my project here, which is called the Integrity in Science Project, is funded by foundations, in part, I should say, by some foundations that have an interest in environmental health, the Belden Foundation and some others. So the fact is I spend probably more than 50% of my time working on medical issues for which, for one reason or another, I can't raise any money on. But then CSPI itself as an organization takes no money from companies or the government, I might add, and is largely funded through its Nutrition Action Health Letter. And, of course, we're a 501c3. So that's, you know, and, I mean, our position is that we will not take money from either companies or the government.
And UCS has the same position. I mean, we are funded mostly by membership and foundation and individual donors, and we take no money at all from corporate or government. But more broadly, I mean, I think, you know, our position is also one of balance. I mean, I think we need to be certain that a preconceived notion of how it should be.
Thank you very much. We have one more. We don't have time to get into it here because we're up on our hour, but Carolyn Raffensperger, who has done a lot of work on precautionary approaches, has a comment. It seems to me that regulation is too late to really address conflicts of interest in good science. Shouldn't we start with the true public interest research agenda? That small question we don't have time to get into, but I want to thank all of our speakers and participants very much for joining in, and I'm going to turn it back to Eleni for closing comments here.
Thanks, Steve. I just want to also thank everyone who's participated in the blog. There's some lively questions and posting going on. And please note that if you'd like to continue to make comments about this call or would like to make any other questions available for us, we can forward them along. Please feel free to use the blog to do that. We will keep it up for a while for folks to use. The last thing I want to say is that our next partnership call is on May 24th at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern. We're going to be focusing on electromagnetic radiation. It should be a very interesting call. So we will be disseminating information about that over the next week or two. Thanks, everyone, very much to our speakers and our commenters for joining us, and we look forward to talking with you next month. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.